Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:28 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time, and today is November 23rd. And I thought I would kick off today with cryptocurrencies because Bitcoin was down about $180 today, but that is a shade of the kind of performance we've seen everywhere else in the cryptocurrency sector. One thing that has certainly been drawing attention over the weekend was the fact that it looks like PayPal has been buying up Bitcoin, at least lots of the new supply. And when you look at any asset class where a great deal of the supply is already held off the market and the free float is already quite thin, and then any new supply is being hoovered up by new entrants into the market, well then, against a background where you've got tight supply and rising demand, that is the formula for a bull market. And what it is also starting to create is some anticipation about if there is a supply inelasticity argument around Bitcoin, will then it create a similar type of action in some of the associated products? Well, one way that people were anxious to play the market back in 2016 and 17 was with companies that had plenty of access to supply. So for example, Overstock had been accepting Bitcoin, so, and they weren't using it for anything else, so they had a stockpile, and that sent the share up in a very dramatic fashion. In fact, it rallied even more this year because of the stay-at-home phenomenon, but it is bouncing now from the region of the trend mean. Square has been one of the big beneficiaries of the fintech sector over the course of the last 8 or 9 months. In many respects, when you go to a store now, you don't use cash any longer, and they email you the receipt. That is a reflection of the kind of technology that Square is implementing and is getting a lot of uptake from various vendors. So there is certainly the potential there that if they also start enabling people to transact with cryptocurrencies, that it will also be viewed in much the same way that Overstock was all the way back in 2016-17. But the real news story around cryptocurrencies today was with Ethereum and Ripple and some of the altcoins. So we had the fact that Bitcoin has led on the upside, then Ethereum has been playing catch-up, and it broke out of its first step above the base on Friday, and then followed through on the upside yesterday, and then again today on Monday. So one thing that is worth highlighting is that cryptocurrencies don't generally trade on Saturday, but they do trade on Sundays. And we've often seen that they have tended to have outsized moves in the weekend periods when a lot of people are not really paying much attention to the market. But it's looking increasingly likely now that Ethereum has completed its first step above the base and that there is ample scope here for additional upside. Then when we look at Ripple, it has been playing catch up with Ethereum. It romped on the upside yesterday and opened at a new recovery high and followed through on the upside in here today. So this is really quite impressive action, and it's now a clear recovery candidate, having clearly broken the downtrend. This probably is all of the evidence that anyone might need to suggest that the altcoins are now in the process of playing catch up with Bitcoin. When we look at IOTA, for example, it has also rallied really rather well in the last few days, but it hasn't been able to push on to new recovery highs yet. So Ripple is among those that is doing quite well. Litecoin is also doing reasonably well. Unfortunately, Bloomberg isn't the best venue for looking at charts of the cryptocurrencies, because it just doesn't have the back history and it has a very limited number of them. But you can see, for example, that Litecoin has been able to push on to new recovery highs, although not quite in as dynamic a manner as Ripple has. All of this, of course, begs the question, are we in the middle of a massive transition towards cryptocurrencies taking over the entire world or completely supplanting the established financial sector? That's an argument for the biggest bulls, I fear. I think we just there's no way to make that determination right now. But one thing we certainly know is that there's a great deal of money flowing into this sector. And also, there are a lot of smart people that are transacting in it and are working very hard on the code underlying it. And at least from that perspective, when you have got such a vast sum of brain capital focused on a sector, then it is quite likely they're going to come up with something that is of use to the global economy. Well, then when we look at the gold sector, gold was down in a reasonably dynamic manner in here today and pushed down to a new reaction low. It has not quite yet unwound all of the overextension relative to the trend mean, but we're really not that far off it either. And silver was down about 75 cents, so it is now coming back down. One thing that I think is particularly noteworthy is that there has been a preponderance of downward dynamics within this range since the peak back in early August. So there is still a downward bias to trading overall, and it's unwinding this really quite impressive breakout that we had earlier in the year. When we then think about, well, why might that be the case? Why isn't aren't gold and silver attracting the same kind of interest as the cryptocurrencies? Well, on the one hand, I think a lot of people were getting into gold and silver because of a risk trade, that it should do well in the aftermath of a stock market crash. That's exactly what happened in 2008. And it's, again, what happened on this occasion. We had a very substantial move. So that was the right thing to do then. But we've also had in here today some loss of interest in hedging risk. AstraZeneca was in negative territory today, despite the fact that they came out with an average efficacy rate for their phase 3 trial of about 70% and as high as potentially 90%. One thing that AstraZeneca's dosage has an advantage in terms of is that it works at room temperature, so it's also going to be substantially cheaper than either Pfizer or Moderna's. But the reality is that it hasn't won the race. And consumers will likely demand the best. So even though a 70% average efficacy rate is really quite impressive and would pass muster in just about any other year, well, when you've got 90% and 95% efficacy rates, then the argument is rather moot. People are going to simply pick the best one. But from a longer, medium-term perspective, the fact that we have got lots of different potential solutions, it's really quite beneficial for the global economy, but perhaps not so much for the stay-at-homes. And when we look at, for example, Apple, it was down 3% today. And it has also held a sequence of lower rally highs since August. When we look at it on a longer-term logarithmic scale, then one of its defining characteristics is that it has tended to find support in the region of the upper side of the underlying range. But if we were to see that level tested again, it would take it down to $80, and that is a substantial contraction from where it is trading today. Also, we have to at least just think about the market in a common sense way. Some of these companies did enormously well as a result of the lockdowns, because it forced businesses and consumers to front load their purchases of technology and remote working and learning solutions to this year. That trend towards remote work and access to the cloud and streaming, for example, well, that's been underway for a while. And there's been a lot of there was a lot of commentary back in 2019 that it was the future, that it was going to represent a very significant transition that would take years to take place. But the reality is, it's taken place in the space of about 6 months, and the growth rates that have been priced into these shares are really very impressive, and perhaps phenomenal is not an exaggeration. But it's going to be very difficult to repeat that next year if we are getting a plethora of different vaccines, and that is just the ones that have been permissioned or are on the cusp of being permissioned in North America and Europe. Then Russia also has theirs, and so does China. So we are likely to see an incredibly large number of vaccines being produced globally in 2021. And that suggests that the entire argument for lockdowns is going to become rather moot within the space of about 3 months. And when that has occurred, well, people are going to, I think, very actively rebel against staying at home. When they come blinking out into the sunlight from having spent 8 or 9 months cooped up at home, well, people are obviously going to spend a little bit of time blinking in the sunlight and thinking about, golly, how is this all going to work? And then they'll forget about it and get back to their normal lives. And I think that is, that's certainly one potential, I think the most likely outcome. We can also think about, you know, when people from areas that have very severe winters, when they are cooped up at home for much of the time, and then when the sun comes out, well, then they just really take to the outdoors in a very aggressive manner to make the most of it. And that would suggest that by the time we get to the spring of 2021, that people are going to be really very anxious to get out and about. When we look at a number of charts, I think that there are significant numbers that have been doing rather well. One thing I think is particularly interesting is that the Korean market is powering on the upside, and it's being led by Samsung Electronics. Now, that was also a company that has been benefiting from the stay-at-home environment, but it's also one that benefits from global growth. Then when we think about the global industrials sector, well, I think this is another really very impressive chart. When this we think about this index, it's mostly US industrials, but it has European ones as well, and Asian ones. It has been ranging now for nearly 3 years, but then it broke out last week and flooded through on the upside this week. This is, I think, really quite impressive. So there is certainly the potential that industrial shares are going to do better next year, because we're already seeing them turning to outperformance. Then we also know that small caps are much more levered to domestic reflation, and when domestic reflation is a priority for every country in the world, then it contributes to synchronized global economic expansion, and the Russell 2000 has clearly broken on the upside. So that's putting the S&P 500 in the shade here, and the S&P was in positive territory today, and it has so far held the breakout to new all-time highs, but it's been really quite inert. And the challenge for a big cap index like this is that it is some of the best performing shares were also the largest shares. They were also the ones that did best from the lockdowns. So we could see a period of time where it underperforms. What we can also think about is that the Dow Jones is a price weighted index rather than a market cap weighted index. So it's outperforming. It's being led higher today by Chevron, which is obviously an energy company, and Boeing, which has been one of the most benighted of all the industrials. And one thing that we can also think about is that if people are going to be looking to get back into the sunshine, well, then demand for travel will also likely to be likely to increase. So there are certainly those phenomena. But if we are moving into a period of synchronized global economic expansion, well, then the commodity sector should also do well. And the equal weight commodity index is pushing on the upside. When we then think about the kinds of commodities that are doing well, agriculturals have certainly been breaking out of bases more recently. And Mosaic has been trending downwards for 9 years. This isn't the first time it's been able to push back above the trend mean, but every other time it has failed in a very dynamic manner. If it can sustain the move above 20, then I think we have at least a reasonable argument that the benefit of the doubt can be given the upside as long as it's holding the region of the trend mean. And it's incredibly depressed relative to the price that it was trading at back in 2010 and 11. So then when we think about the industrial metals, there's been really significant rationalization in the sector over the course of the last few years. One thing that has been quite clear is that the large companies benefited the most. They were the ones that have been able to keep their production going. They've been able to rationalize most effectively. There have been a significant number went bust. And then when we think about the FTSE 350 mining index, it is represented by most of the big mining companies, and it's coming back up towards that psychological 20,000 level. And it's been ranging below that for the last 8 years. So I think that the closest historical parallel to what we have right now is the period in 2002. We had the tech bust in 1999, then 9/11, in 2001, and people really did believe that they were never going to fly again. But within 12 months, there was a significant recovery in the airline sector. And before the pandemic, what we had in fact seen was that air traffic had tripled in size in the space of that 20-year period. So what we're potentially looking at here is, with synchronized global economic expansion, the clear intention of investors to bet on that, and for governments to do everything possible to fuel it. Well, then where is the demand growth driver going to come from that we had back in the early 2000s? Because back then, it was China's accession to the WTO created this massive demand for commodities. And it was that factor that really stoked investment demand in commodities themselves, miners and commodity producers, and then the commodity exporting countries as well. Well, copper prices were a little weaker in here today. Nickel is also one of the industrial resources that has been in a choppy trend, but it has been held to this upward bias overall. And lithium prices are just beginning to turn the corner. If we really want to think about what the demand growth driver might be, well, there is the realistic possibility that it could be in terms of green energy. When we think about the fact that Europe is intent on increasing its wind capacity by 25 times in the next 30 years, and that just in the next decade alone, they have got extraordinary growth figures that they wish to complete. Well, that's going to require a very significant amount of infrastructure. And it's also particularly true for the solar sector. So that's likely to be a secular growth trend, because there are massive quantities of money flowing into this sector. And the solar ETF was at a new closing high in here today. It has done spectacularly well this year, but more importantly than that, it's continued to keep going. And it is still at only a fraction of the price that it was back in 2008. So this has been a very impressive base formation completion, and we're probably really only in the early stages of this move. One thing that is hampering the supply of solar cells is a shortage of glass for photovoltaic cells. Now that is probably likely going to ease in 21 and 22, but we're really only just moving in terms of the breakout from this long base formation. Then the wind ETF has also continued to push on to new recovery highs. And there is the potential, at least, that with these massive plans to build out green hydrogen infrastructure, this is in terms of the billions and billions of dollars that are going to be required to fund these projects that are springing up all over the world, with the clear determination to become carbon neutral, then it's going to require a great deal of infrastructure building. And whether that is in terms of efficiency, in terms of consumption, or efficiency in terms of production, obviously these are significant potential sources of demand for commodities and infrastructure and industrials. And all of that is contributing to where we're seeing this return to performance overall. But then, of course, we have oil. And the reality is that a lot of people have bought cars this year. And once you buy a car, you tend to drive it. So the reality is that as the lockdowns end, people are more than likely going to be driving more miles. There's been a lot of talk about the migration of people to the suburbs, and that being a knee-jerk reaction to the pandemic. And there is certainly some truth to that. But I think we do need to cast our minds back to the period in 2008, 9, and 10, where there was a lot of commentary about young people moving to the city. Well, a lot of those young people now have young children, and this is a natural time where people would migrate to the suburbs. So it, again, has probably been an accelerant and just simply pushed people in terms of the decision that they were already halfway to making. Well, when people move to the suburbs, you inevitably end up driving more because there's less concentration and less public transport. And oil prices pushed on to a new recovery high in here today. And when we look at the energy sector, it is rebounding in a pretty dynamic manner. And of course, the other important point is that oil is a significant determinant of the cost of production for all other commodities. So when commodity prices had already been recovering, that was without the benefit of a rising oil price. But now you have a rising oil price, it's going to create a push factor in terms of the cost of production of all commodities. So there is the potential that we could be looking at commodity price inflation and asset price inflation going forward. There's obviously also been some unease in the market about the measures undertaken by Steve Mnuchin to withdraw some of the largesse that's been afforded the Federal Reserve in supporting the market. It was a timely effort in terms of the decision because we've seen the economy come back faster than was anticipated. The Federal Reserve, having announced a large number of programs, didn't in fact have to do very much with them. Just simply announcing them was enough to change investor sentiment. But then, of course, we have the fact that there's going to be a new administration, and we are looking into a period of divided government, and the current administration doesn't seem to want to have leave any stone unturned in terms of trying to make the life of the next administration more difficult. So that virtually ensures there's going to be more quantitative easing. And the fact that just before I started recording, Joe Biden has now confirmed that he's going to appoint Janet Yellen as the Treasury Secretary, well, that ensures a very smooth transition in terms of the relationship between the Treasury and the Federal Reserve. It also greatly enhances the potential for modern monetary theory to become reality. And I think when that, or I guess a permanent reality, when people start to get that into their minds, well, then demand for precious metals is likely to continue to come back. But we are still in a corrective phase for the precious metal markets, and it is setting us up for the next attractive buying opportunity. And with that, I'll leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.